CareForTheArts.org.
Welcome, I'm Sean Kinney. On this hour, we're going to bring you an update on the health of the Gulf of Mexico from a USF scientist nearly 9 years after the BP oil disaster. We're going to take your calls with your thoughts. The number is 813-239-9663. You can also email dj at wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885. Well, in April of 2010, the BP Deepwater Horizon exploded and nearly 5 million barrels of oil spewed into the Gulf of Mexico over the course of several weeks. The Gulf ecosystem was damaged, and researchers are trying to find out how badly. And today we will talk to one of the main scientists. But first, we're going to hear a listener comment, a short listener comment that was left about yesterday's show. Yesterday, we heard the State of the State address from new Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. And here is one listener calling in to talk about the new governor.
It's graduation season, and we continue now with our special series about rethinking.
Me that there is a book called How to Democrat in the Age of Trump by Mike Lux. And if you want to find out why Democrats lose elections and how to win the White House and the Senate back in 2020 and get ready for the political attacks coming from not only the Republicans and the oligarchs, but from the corporate media, too, like the Washington Post and New York Times and on against Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. And it'll be a good idea to read as much as you can about the topic of socialism and how the Republicans and corporations will tie Maduro's Venezuelan socialist government to a future president like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, for that matter. So we, the progressive left, have to be ready to respond to those political attacks. And I've noticed that even public TV, Evening News, and NPR label Bernie and Elizabeth as extreme leftists. And Tulsi Gabbard, they're horrified. Corporate media is horrified. Oh, they can't even talk about Tulsi Gabbard, you know. So for the rest of the other Democrats, you know, they're moderate, they're okay. But Bernie and Elizabeth and Tulsi, forget it, you know. So that's what you get from public TV and NPR and other public radio stations that call themselves public radio stations.
Well, that was one listener commenting about yesterday's show. It's on our website, WMNF.org/news. Later on in the broadcast, I'll give out the number for you to leave a voicemail about today's show. And you can always listen to previous shows and comment on the stories on WMNF.org/news or Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at WMNF News. Well, you're listening to 88.5 FM, WMNF Tampa, WMNF.org. And in April of 2010, the BP Deepwater Horizon exploded and nearly 5 million barrels of oil spewed into the Gulf of Mexico over several weeks. The Gulf ecosystem was damaged, and researchers are trying to figure out how badly. One of the main scientists looking at the health of the Gulf is our guest on WMNF 88.5 FM today. Steve Morawski is a professor at the University of South Florida College of Marine Science in St. Petersburg. He's the lead author of a 7-year study that was just published in the journal Marine and Coastal Fisheries. It looks at the makeup of marine organisms in the Gulf of Mexico from the U.S., from Cuba, and Mexico. Welcome back to WMNF 88.5 FM, Steve.
Thank you very much, Sean. It's great to be with you and your listeners.
I'm glad that you're joining us. Thank you so much. The goal of this research is to find out what's out there in the Gulf of Mexico. And in the paper, you say that it's the first comprehensive systematic fishery-independent survey of the Gulf of Mexico continental shelves. So what did you find in this multi-year study?
Well, we found out quite a bit. The study was aimed at, number one, looking at the entirety of the Gulf as opposed to just the northern Gulf in the U.S. or just the southern Gulf in Mexico and Cuba. Some of the species that we have here in the United States occur throughout the Gulf, and some of them occur only in some places. And so understanding how populations interrelate and how connected they are around a large ecosystem like the Gulf is really key to understanding the recovery potential from a disaster like Deepwater Horizon. One of the other major points of this large-scale survey was to collect contaminant data throughout the Gulf of Mexico. There really was never a baseline from which to judge a disaster like Deepwater Horizon prior to the conduct of this large study. And so that sets the baseline now for anything that might happen in the future.
And that baseline was a really important part of your research, because you've said neither the fish nor oil spills know national boundaries, and you're gathering this baseline information for Gulf of Mexico species. How will that help scientists and managers prepare for future disasters like oil spills?
Yeah, it's a great point. And, for an iconic species like the red snapper, which is always a source of controversy and a source of great economic value to Americans, we now know that there's a continuous distribution of red snapper, not only in U.S. waters, but throughout most of Mexico as well. And so what happens in Mexico influences red snapper populations in the United States and vice versa. And so that gives managers a bigger context to try to understand the impacts of a large-scale spill like this. And so that's just one species, and the study itself collected about almost 175 different species, and so the Gulf is a very biodiverse place, and so trying to understand all these impacts is of critical importance if we're going to look at the recovery from a large-scale disaster like this.
And in your research, you were able to divide the Gulf into several zones. One of them is the West Florida Shelf, which is off the west coast of Florida, and it stretches all the way around to Cuba. And I guess if you went in a counterclockwise orientation, it would go all the way to Cuba, and there were six separate geographic zones. What can you say, since you were talking about the red snapper, what can you say about the abundance of red snapper in some of those zones, and maybe how that's changed over time since the spill?
Sure. Red snapper are most abundant in the northern Gulf of Mexico, off Louisiana and Alabama, and in the western part of the Gulf of Mexico, off Texas. They're not very abundant at all off Mexico, and the interesting thing is, if you go just right across the boundary, from just south of the boundary between Mexico and the United States to just north, there's a dramatic increase in fish abundance that we attribute basically to the effectiveness of fisheries management in the northern Gulf, that the animals are larger and they're much more dense on the U.S. side. And so, obviously the management of things like red snapper is always contentious, but this is a clear demonstration that the restrictive management that has gone on the U.S. side has really built up the population and made fishing much easier and much more productive.
Our guest is Steve Murawski, a professor at the University of South Florida College of Marine Science in St. Petersburg, and we're talking about the health of the Gulf of Mexico in the 9 years since the BP oil disaster. My name is Sean Canaan. You're listening to 88.5 FM, WMNF.org. It's 11:14 in the morning, and if you'd like to call in and ask a question, the number is 813-239-9663. You can email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. And Dr. Murawski, I'd like to ask you about the interesting finding that you had, where the most management, the most strict management of resources is where you find the most abundance of fish. But that also, I don't know if this is coincidence, and maybe you can tell me what you know about this, but that's also where the most oil drilling is, right?
Yeah, it's really kind of a paradox that you've got a lot of oil drilling in the western part of the Gulf and in the northern part of the Gulf, but you also have a lot of oil drilling in the Yucatan region of Mexico as well. And so if we look at the Yucatan area of Mexico, for example, they generate almost as much oil as we do in the United States from a relatively small group of oil fields there. But the status of resources is in much poorer condition. So it's not really the oil drilling per se that's resulting in either higher or lower abundance. It's more like the natural resource management policies and their effectiveness in the two countries.
And you also, I think if I read it correctly, you attribute some of the increase in production there to the area having more phytoplankton. Could that be because the area off of Mexico is maybe a drier land area that doesn't introduce as many nutrients into the water?
That's certainly the case. And when we we can look with satellites at the amount of phytoplankton, the small plankton that are the basis of the food chain throughout the Gulf, right? And invariably, the highest rates of production are in the northern and the eastern part of the Gulf here off West Florida. And down there, there are fewer rivers that discharge into the near coastal area, which, you know, are a source of nutrients. And so there's an underlying productivity issue in the southwestern Gulf of Mexico. And so that feeds its way up through the food chain. Also, one of the major impacts that we saw from this study was that sharks are quite abundant in the northern Gulf of Mexico. They're very abundant in terms of the number of species and the density of sharks. Not so much in the southern part. And so this is a bit of a quandary. You know, why do we see so few sharks? Well, it's interesting because in Mexico, there's a much more active shark fishery. And so we think part of this is, you know, sharks tend to be long-lived and slow-growing, and they have very limited reproductive capability. So it could be that the differences that we're seeing in sharks are actually a reflection of the management scheme as well.
Our guest is Steve Morawski, a professor at the University of South Florida College of Marine Science in St. Petersburg. We're talking about the health of the Gulf of Mexico nearly 9 years after the BP oil disaster. You're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF.org. It's 11:17 in the morning, and you can call in with your thoughts, 813-239-9663, email dj at WMNF.org, or text 813-433-0885. In your study, Steve, you're in the process of testing the specimens that you've collected for things like oil, organic pollutants, and heavy metals. And I don't think you've finished collecting things or analyzing the data, but what can you tell us about how it looks so far, especially in the region where the Deepwater Horizon disaster was?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So in the northern part of the Gulf, we actually have been up there six different times, and so we're looking at a time series of contaminants. And we see a fairly significant drop-off in some of the animals like red snapper and others. And then in other animals like tilefish, which are a burrowing species, we actually see contaminants in the bile, which is a good indicator of recent contamination, actually increasing. And one thing we know about the contamination from Deepwater Horizon is that a significant quantity of that oil reached the bottom and dwells there now. And so we feel that what's happened is these animals that dig in the bottom are continuing to repollute themselves with the sedimented oil. And so that's a finding that, you know, is counterintuitive, that, you know, not all oil floats. You know, how does it get to the bottom? And so we've done a lot of parallel studies to try to understand the, you know, how oil is transported throughout the ecosystem, and particularly how it actually gets to the bottom.
And I think in previous interviews, you've referred to that as marine snow, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, about where the oil kind of drifts down to the bottom.
That's right. And so in some, you know, in sort of joking way, we call that the secondhand snow, you know, in terms of the contamination of the bottom-dwelling fishes. There's this there's a continuous rain of dead matter in the ocean that starts at the surface waters where they're more productive, and animals and plants die and they drift to the bottom, and that whole process is called marine snow. During the oil spill, this was enhanced by the use of dispersants, which that and the oil itself resulted in a massive die-off of these small animals in the surface water, and to the point where we called it marine blizzard, because the marine snow piled up so quickly relative to the baseline rate. And so we feel that the snow itself, as it moved through the water column, basically contacted oil droplets and brought them to the bottom.
And we have an email that asks about the dispersants that you were just talking about. This is from David. He says, could your guest speak about the effect of dispersants used after the Deepwater Horizon disaster? Are there any long-term effects on people and wildlife from those dispersant chemicals? Is one of his questions, and I'll ask the second question as well. Also, why aren't we hearing more about the Taylor Energy oil spill? I think it should get more press, and this was a spill that began off of Louisiana, I believe, in 2004 after Hurricane and Ivan. So would you like to address those two questions, please?
Sure. Let me talk about Taylor a bit. Unlike deep water, which was we would call a chronic, an acute oil spill, it happened over 87 days, but it was done with. Right, and so now we're trying to track what's happening. Taylor has been an oil field. There were about 25 wells under Taylor, and it was up slope from deep water. It was off the coast of Louisiana in somewhat shallow water. And what happened was there was a massive underwater landslide that basically knocked the Taylor platform and its wells off their moorings. Right, and so that started basically a long-term release that's been happening since 2004. I mean, that's 15 years, right? Now, the quantity of being released by Taylor is somewhere between, I think the estimates are 48 to 1,900 barrels a day, which is a significant amount, but it kind of pales in terms of the total quantity of deep water, which was 200 million gallons, right? So we're about 5 million barrels. So in one case you had this huge acute spill. In this case you've got a chronic long-term spill. And certainly that can result in much different impacts on the biota, which haven't really been studied that well. A lot of the work at Taylor has been trying to see if they can figure out a way to actually cap it, which is problematic because the well itself has blown out into the rock formation underneath. And so it's hard to pinpoint a single source. So that's a long-term issue. On the dispersant issue, there's been a lot of work and speculation about the long-term impacts of dispersants. Dispersants are basically chemicals, much like detergents, that break oil droplets into smaller components that are more easily worked on by the bacteria that are in the ocean, that is digested by the bacteria. So that's the theory of dispersants, that it makes big droplets into small ones. It also makes it more bioavailable, which means that more animals, including plankton, can actually consume it, right? So there's an upside and a downside. Number one, you're trying to get rid of the oil as fast as you can through natural processes, but also it becomes more available to the animals. The components in the dispersants themselves are not enormously toxic. The use of dispersants started with the Torrey Canyon oil spill in Europe a long time ago, and originally they used things like paint thinner, which broke up the oil, but were incredibly toxic. The chemicals now are we would call them mildly toxic. And the real issue is, and this is an unresolved issue, is whether or not what we call chemically enhanced oil, that is chemically treated oil with dispersants, are more toxic than the oil itself. And there's a long-running debate, and frankly, the issue is unresolved scientifically.
And the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, found that human health was harmed by dispersants used by BP. This was a few years after the spill. This study came out that the NIH found symptoms like coughing, wheezing, burning eyes, or skin irritation. Some were temporary, some long-lasting. And I assume that means that it was probably mostly among people who were applying the dispersants and were in close contact?
That's right. I mean, one of the issues we have, of course, is that dispersants are always released in the presence of oil. And so you've got this synergy between the oil and the dispersants. So you don't know whether any of these sublethal symptoms are due to the dispersants themselves or due to the oil or in combination. And that's where it's really difficult to tease out, what exactly is the controlling factor.
Our guest is Steve Morawski, a professor at the University of South Florida College of Marine Science in St. Petersburg. My name is Sean Canaan. In this hour, we're bringing you an update on the health of the Gulf of Mexico from a USF scientist nearly 9 years after the BP oil disaster. You're listening to 88.5 FM, WMNF.org. It's 11:25 in the morning. morning. You're welcome to call in with your questions, 813-239-9663. You can email DJ at WMNF.org or text 813-433-0885. So, Dr. Murawski, as you were studying the Gulf of Mexico, the biota of the animals and plants that were living in the Gulf of Mexico, and you were looking at the areas near the oil spill, the oil spill was one big stressor, but in that same general area of the Gulf, the Northern Gulf, you also have things like there's lots of fisheries and the Gulf Dead Zone, the waters that flow down out of the Mississippi River that creates the Gulf Dead Zone. How can you pull apart which things are causing the declines, for example, in the red snapper? Is there a way to tell what are the causes of the declines?
That's a really important point that, we're not looking at an oil spill in a vacuum, right? It's in the context of all the other things that are ongoing in a very heavily utilized body of water. That the Northern Gulf area, for example, has the discharge from the Mississippi River, which is draining about 40% of the continental United States. And so that brings toxics and nutrients and a variety of pollutants into the system. And the nutrients coming down the Mississippi are primarily implicated in the formation of these dead zones out to the west side of the river south of Louisiana. And that's a kind of an annual occurrence, and there seems to be a relationship between the amount of nitrogen fertilizer coming down the Mississippi and the extent of that dead zone. That dead zone is actually not in the primary zone of influence of Deepwater Horizon. It's a little bit farther inshore into the west. And there was a lot of speculation that dead zone might actually have been enhanced by the deep water, but it appears not. But you're right, there are other stressors like fishing, for example, and fishing has been curtailed on a lot of the main species to sustainable levels. And so, trying to understand, how fisheries might interact is important. Now, during the spill, there was a massive area that was closed to fishing, primarily to make sure that tainted seafood didn't get on the market. And so, so for a number of months, there was no fishing going on in these areas, and some of the short life species, they pop up in abundance if they're not being heavily fished, like shrimp and other species. But it doesn't seem like that was across the board. Again, those closures are short enough that it probably didn't really influence the long-term population abundance or increase the abundance just because of that. So, yeah, trying to deconvolve all the different stressors in an environment like this is difficult. And this is where we try to use computer simulation models to help us look at all the stressors and look at what would happen if you reduce them one at a time.
Your collaborators on this recent paper are from Texas, Mexico, and Cuba, so that kind of geographically encompasses a lot of the Gulf of Mexico. Why is it important that you did a kind of an international study with scientists from Cuba and Mexico in addition to the United States?
Well, the entirety of the Gulf is under exploration now. The Mexicans are being quite active these days and trying to find new sources, and they're doing a seismic surveys throughout their zone, which is just as large as the United States' zone. And the Cubans as well. I mean, they have an oil deficit there. Their oil source has been Venezuela, but that's a very difficult situation at this point, and they need domestic oil supplies, and so they're very interested in exploration along the north and western coasts of Cuba as well, which intersect with our portion of the zone. And so trying to understand baselines and where contaminants go is important, not only in our national interest, but in the national interests of all three countries. And, these oil spills, particularly from deep water well failures, if they go on for an extended period of time, these oil spills will range over a large extent of the Gulf. And some of the computer simulations we've done indicate that the places where the oil industries are going in all three countries would result in more of an international outcome than Deepwater did. And so it's in all of our best interest to get the baselines, to understand resources at risk, and to try to implement policies that reduce the risks of actually having another catastrophic blowout to as close to zero as we can.
Our guest is Steve Murawski, a professor at the University of South Florida College of Marine Science in St. Petersburg. We're talking about the health of the Gulf of Mexico after the BP oil disaster. And you're welcome to call in to 88.5 FM, WMNF.org, and we'll put you on the air. The number is 813-239-9663. You can email DJ at WMNF.org or text 813-433-0885. We're going to go to a call right now from Christine in Tampa. Hi, Christine. Can you go ahead and make your point as we try to get our guest back on the air? Go ahead, Christine.
Sure. Hey, Sean. I actually became an environmental activist after the BP oil spill and did some research about the dispersant that was used called chlorhexit, which is banned, I believe, in at least 19 other countries. And the way the chlorhexit works, besides the bioavailability, is it also sinks the oil. So it's hard to measure how much oil has actually been released when there is a disaster. And oil companies, of course, pay a fee or a fine for the amount of oil they spill. So I think we're leaving that out of the discussion. And I'd like to know the professor's view exactly, or the research that he's done on a particular dispersant chlorhexit.
And we're going to have to try to get him back on the line, Christine. I appreciate that call. I'll ask him about that. So I'll definitely ask him that question when we get him back on the line. And I apologize to our listeners. We'll get that right back in just a second. You're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. And our guest is Steve Murawski, a professor at the University of South Florida College of Marine Science in St. Petersburg. We're going to get him back on the line in just a second. And I want to read something else. A few years ago when I talked to him, he said that that because there were fewer skin lesions on fish, that was evidence that BP, that's evidence that the BP disaster was causing the skin lesions because there were fewer as time went by afterwards. And so that was evidence that the skin lesions was caused by the oil because it was declining over time. And that's something that we'll ask him as we get him back on the line. I want to read one other thing that I want to remind you about, a show that's coming up later. Tomorrow we'll get an update on the death penalty in Florida and about bills introduced in the new legislative session to end capital punishment in the state. So that's at tomorrow, 11. That's at 11 tomorrow morning, so I hope you tune in for that. After this show is Midpoint Wednesday with NOLA. That's coming up later on at 12 o'clock, so you can call in right now, 813-239-9663, and we'll take your call. And our guest is Steve Murawski, a professor at the University of South Florida College of Marine Science in St. Petersburg, and that we're talking about him about the health of the Gulf of Mexico, and we have him back on the line. Welcome back, Steve. Thanks for being patient with us.
Thanks. You were asking me about skin lesions on fishes, and I assume you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. And a couple of years ago, I interviewed you about that. There was a study out that said that the skin lesions had declined in the years since right after the Gulf the BP disaster. And you told me then that was evidence that the oil or the oil and dispersants were causing the lesions, and that's why they were going away. Is that still what you think?
But yes, I'm even more convinced about that now for two reasons. Number one, now we've got 7 years of data post-spill, and what we've found is that the prevalence of these, particularly in species like red snapper, have really gone to zero. They're very much a rare event. And secondly, there was a really great set of experiments that were done at the University of Southern Mississippi where they put some similar kinds of fish in aquaria and then exposed them to oil and then a bath of bacteria. And then they also did some control animals where they just exposed them to the oil, but just the bacteria, but not the oil. And the ones that had the oil, then the bacteria, were not able to fight off the infections, and they induced the skin lesions, whereas the ones that were in the bath with the bacteria but not oiled did not show those symptoms. So that gives us a mechanism by which these really grotesque skin lesions actually form. So I'm pretty convinced, number one, that the monitoring data plus the experimental data really, you can never prove a negative, but in this case, it's a high likelihood that that was the proximal cause of these symptoms. And we got that information from fishermen themselves. You know, they are sentinels in terms of the health of the populations, and they were right on it as far as I was concerned.
So would these fish that had the lesions, would they have been healthy to eat? And I guess the second part of that question would be, now that fish have fewer lesions, is the seafood in the Gulf safe?
To the second question, yes. Any seafood that you're going to buy in a commercial fish market, it undergoes a certain level of testing. And so, and particularly during that episode and thereafter, there was an enormous amount of seafood testing. The kinds of animals that we're dealing with, though, I mean, it would be very rare to have contaminant levels of oil in the flesh that would be problematic. And that's because these animals, much like people, clear this through their gallbladder liver system, and very little of it bioaccumulates in the flesh. This is oil contaminants. And so that's not really a problem.
Well, let's take another question from Doug. Doug, go ahead.
Hi. I apologize if you addressed this somewhat, but I know there's a on the radio, I mean, I hear advertising right now, the petroleum industry or institute is pushing, you know, offshore drilling off the coast of Florida, and what a great benefit it is, and all these environmental regulations are so strict, and oil drilling now is so safe that there's just not going to be, I presume they're implying that there's not going to be a chance of any spilling. I was wondering if your guest could address, I assume that their offshore drilling is allowed in Texas and other parts of the Gulf, and is there a relationship with the quality of the Gulf, you know, the in those areas as compared to off the coast of Florida? And also, how close right now, I know there's a, I think there's a ban on offshore drilling, but how close is the, how close can they drill now?
Yep. No, those are great questions. Let me kind of update you on where we stand. Currently, there's a moratorium in drilling off of Florida, and it extends out to about 125 miles, which puts that out in the very deep water, 2,000 to 3,000 meter depths. You know, so it's really deep area. That moratorium expires in 2022, and there's quite a debate about, you know, if it'll be retained or modified, which, you know, potentially allows the oil industry closer to Florida. One of the interesting things that's happening in the Gulf, it's a very dynamic situation, that most of the wells in shallow water, particularly off Texas and Louisiana, they're primarily gas wells, and the gas production in the Gulf of Mexico has gone down very dramatically. Because the gas production on land is much cheaper, and so it only accounts for about 3% of all natural gas now in the United States. And frankly, the oil companies aren't particularly interested in marine gas because it's expensive. But what's happened is the oil wells are becoming, they're being sunk much deeper than they used to be. And for the first time in 2017, more oil was taken from wells a mile deep and deeper than the shallower wells. And much of that oil production is now coming from an area south and east of Deepwater Horizon, directly south of the Panhandle, right? And so it's clear that the oil industry is moving from west to east. Right? And they're butting up against this moratorium boundary. And so there's a lot of interest in the oil companies to, you know, nudge that boundary closer to Florida, because that seems to be a play that's quite productive at this point. So that's a problem. One of the issues that it brings to light is that that area is subject to a very intensive current system called the loop current. The places where they want to extend to, the water runs much quicker than it does in the Western Gulf. And so this issue of, you know, is it a safe place to drill becomes more and more important as the oil industry becomes deeper and farther to the east.
Well, thank you for that.
That's a great question.
Yeah, thank you for that question, Doug. I agree. It is a great question. Our guest is Steve Murawski, a professor of the University of South Florida College of Marine Science in St. Petersburg. We're talking about the health of the Gulf of Mexico after the BP oil disaster that happened almost 9 years ago now. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number to call in is 813-239-9663. My name is Sean Canaan. You're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF.org. We're going to go in a little bit to Jim on Gandy, but I want to ask a question that a caller had called in earlier about, and when we accidentally dropped you, and Christine was asking about when the companies have a disaster, they're hit with fines and fees. And I think that she was trying to get to the point is, you know, how much should the company be responsible for, rather, you know, if there's going to be damage to the environment when drilling happens, how much should the company be responsible for? Is that something that you have an answer for?
Well, I mean, that's a larger debate for all of us, you know, in terms of establishing this policy, and this is the policies that Congress and the administration oversee. In the case of Deepwater, the last estimate I saw was that BP had paid about $62 billion in cleanup and in fines. Their fines are over $20 billion. So that brings up a really important issue, and that is, you know, if a company like BP or Shell or Exxon has one of these issues, they have pretty deep pockets to be able to afford something like this. Although, I mean, that spill nearly brought BP to its knees. What happens when you've got these smaller, more boutique oil companies that aren't anywhere near as financed as these large companies? And are the taxpayers on the hook for this?
And this
I don't have an answer to that one.
This might be a good time to bring up the fact that the Gulf of Mexico Research Initiative was established as part of the $500 million that BP spent to study the environmental impact of the Deepwater Horizon disaster. And this research was funded by that Gulf of Mexico Research Initiative, correct?
Yes, that's right. This is really absolutely unprecedented in terms of studying the impacts of an oil spill. Usually what happens is there's some short-term work that's done to try to quantify the damages, and depending on, you know, how significant they are, there might be a few follow-up things. In this case, we're talking about a decade's worth of research following the oil spill, and this has really taught us a lot about how variable the ocean is, how, you know, trying to understand an oil spill in the context of everything else that's going on at the same time, like I talked about before, and also the ability to do things like, you know, go to the other two countries in the Gulf. That was completely financed by the Gulf of Mexico Research Initiative, and it gives us much more context for what's going on. One of the reasons we went to Mexico was that there was a shallow water blowout that occurred in 1979 and 1980, a well called Ixtoc, and that ran for 9 months, and it was about two-thirds the size of Deepwater. Well, there was very little data that were collected at the time after that, but we were actually able to go back to that oil site nearly 40 years after, and we could still find traces of that oil in the deep sediments and up in the coastlines, you know, up in the mangrove forests and other places. And so it gives us some really great understanding of how long an event like that may persist in the environment. And without the funding from GOMRI, we really would have never done those kinds of studies.
And just to reiterate, GOMRI was the Gulf of Mexico Research Initiative that was funded by BP after this disaster, just in case people missed that at the beginning.
Let you know that currently oil drilling is regulated by the Department of Interior. They have an environmental studies program, but it's for the entirety of the United States, and it's only funded at about $35 million a year, which sounds like a lot of money, but this work is expensive, and that's compared to $500 million over 10 years or $50 million a year just for the Gulf of Mexico. And honestly, it's my opinion that we need to dramatically increase the amount of funding that is managed by the government to try to understand these issues and to try to put appropriate information in front of the decision makers that allow them to assess risks and to understand how better to respond to a disaster like this.
Our guest is Steve Murawski, professor at the University of South Florida College of Marine Science in St. Petersburg. You're listening to 88.5 FM, WMNF.org. My name is Sean Canaan. We're going to go to a couple more phone calls if you have a few more minutes, Steve.
Sure, that's fine.
Great, thanks. So we have Jim, who's on Gandy, wants to talk about sunk ships during World War II. Are you still on Gandy, Jim?
No, I'm Bayshore going into Tampa. But in the 6 years of World War II, there were hundreds and hundreds of ships sunk, obviously, and a lot of those were tankers that went down, and many of them along the Gulf, in the Gulf, and especially along the eastern seaboard. And I was wondering how long it took us to the seas and nature to overcome all that, because that's before we had all these chemicals to try and disperse it. And back then it was, let's win the war. We're not really all about saving the environment. So I'm just wondering what the long-term effect, if any, was of all those ships that went down.
All right. Thank you for that question, Jim.
Yeah, that's a great question. Prior to major drilling, the biggest sources of accidents were like you said, ship accidents, and that includes transportation accidents, but also things involving wartime, and certainly there were a number of tankers that were sunk in the Gulf and then out in the Atlantic for sure. The Atlantic ones, I mean, when you're offshore, particularly with diesel fuel, that is very light, and so diesel fuel would a lot of it would evaporate. Crude oil has a much different profile, and it includes a lot of really heavy aspects like asphalt and other things that are more persistent in the environment. After 1942 to 1950, there was quite a bit of oil in the Gulf up on some of the beaches. But, of course, those beaches get worked pretty hard. And so the majority of that probably evaporated or was sequestered, in beach sand and other places. But it was a fairly short-lived event. What really is different about something like deep water is the sheer volume of it and the fact that it influenced both the deep water and the shallow drifting into some of these marshes. So, that certainly was something that, a lot of us thought about, in trying to see if we could track down the traces of this. Really hard to find in terms of an impact. But, again, there wasn't a lot of tracking of where the oil actually ended up.
Well, thank you for that question, Jim. And we're going to take a question from Doug in Clearwater. Hi, Doug.
How's it going?
Great. You're on the air. What's your question?
Well, it's not really a question. It's a comment or an answer. Whenever an oil company has something like this happens and they have to pay fines, those fines are deducted from their taxes. So even though they're fined, we, the taxpayer, pay for it. So anything that happens with big oil, you and I pay for it. That's all I had to say.
All right. Thank you for that comment. And I don't know, Dr. Murawski, do you have anything to add to that?
I don't have anything to add to that. I know that BP was able to write down some of this. I think some of this is negotiable in the case of deep water. I know there was back and forth about how much would be deductible and how much not. It wasn't, a given when they finally settled on that fine. But clearly that was part of the equation.
All right, well, we have also another call from Lenny in Inglewood. I'm going to go there in just a second, but at first I want to remind people that you're listening to WMNF Tampa, 88.5 FM. It's 11:49 in the morning. My name is Sean Canaan, and we're speaking with Steve Murawski, a professor at the University of South Florida College of Marine Science in St. Petersburg, about his recent work surveying it's been going on for years, surveying the Gulf of Mexico after the BP oil disaster. So let's hear from Lenny in Inglewood. Hi, Lenny. All right, we're going to try to go to Lenny in just a second. Okay, hi, Lenny, you're on the air.
Hi. What the professor was talking about funding and budget issues, and I was wondering if he might be able to throw out a number of a budget for a research institute to be able to do the studying that he is proposing, and the number of people involved and what kinds of skills and background they would need to have.
All right, thanks. Go ahead.
Yeah, go. Thank you.
All right, thanks for that call. So, Professor Murawski, what type of resources are required to do research like this?
Well, that's a great question, and you know, it's interesting because our group here at USF is joined by a consortium of 18 other institutions spread out over four continents. And what we're trying to do is bring the expertise we need to something like this. And Lenny asked the question about what skills and expertise are needed. We're trying to do a lot of different things, and the fish work that I've described is just one aspect of a really broad-based study. So, for example, we've got some engineers in Hamburg, Germany, who have recreated the deep water spill in a high-pressure vessel. And so they can add, you know, they can bring the pressure up to a mile deep. They can take the temperature down to 4.5 degrees and inject both oil and dispersants in there to see how effective the dispersants are in if you added them right to the broken well. So that's, you know, that engineering aspect is important. We also have geoscientists who are looking at the amount of oil on the bottom, for example, and that requires whole different sets of skills. Our consortium has been working for 8 years, and our little bit of it is $36 million. So that's an awful lot of money. But when you spread it out over 19 institutions, it's not, you know, definitive in terms of all the questions that arise from a four-dimensional spill like this. I mean, you know, you height and time and then X and Y. And so trying to understand all the aspects of this is really an important question. And so that's kind of what we're dealing with as far as the skills and the budget scale. I can tell you, for example, you know, we go out on a research expedition. Typically, it's like 10 days, right? So just the ship charges for all that work are $10,000 a day. So that's $100,000 just to go out to the site. And that doesn't even start to collect anything or bring it back and analyze it. So you can see that, you know, working in the deep water is an expensive proposition.
Thank you for that question, Lenny. And Dr. Murawski, I should ask you, and we've talked a little bit about all the stressors that are happening in the Gulf, but I kind of want to tie it all together right now. The reason that you're doing the study that you're doing, kind of finding a baseline of what is there in the Gulf of Mexico, what kinds of species, what the fish and so on that are in the Gulf of Mexico, how will that knowledge, having that information, help you to evaluate the resiliency of the Gulf, especially, for example, fish species, to things like overfishing, climate change, pollution, invasive species, and habitat loss, or a potential oil disaster?
Yeah, as you said, all of those things are happening at the same time. And so one of the reasons why the GOMRI-funded research is so important is that we can start to look at recovery rates. And, you know, what is it about individual species that either allow them to recover quicker or more slowly in terms of bringing them back to the pre-spill conditions? And so that's one of the major goals that we have for all of this research is, number one, to be better prepared should there be another disaster like this, to predict what's going to go on. And number two, what can we do in terms of the management of these resources that would make them even more resilient and more able to quickly recover should an accident like this happen? And by understanding the life histories of the animals, how they're distributed, how productive they are, that allows decision makers to be more focused in terms of siting of energy platforms, the kind of regulations and oversight that they need, and then the kinds of recovery and response measures, like, for example, these dispersants, whether we should do it or not. Those are key questions that the managers of energy really need to know.
And I want to go back a little bit. something we were talking about earlier when you were mentioning how deep the wells were now. The Deepwater Horizon well was roughly a mile deep, and at the time it was considered one of the interesting or scary parts about it was how deep it was, 1 mile deep. And as you mentioned, now more than half of them are more than a mile deep, but there are now wells as deep as 2 miles. What would happen if there was a Deepwater Horizon type disaster at a 2 mile deep well?
Yeah, I mean the deepest well is right at 2 miles deep in the Gulf now, and the Gulf actually the deepest part of the Gulf is about 3,800 meters, which puts it darn near 2.5 miles deep, right? So what's different? Well, one of the things that's different is the amount of pressure that's involved in allowing oil droplets to basically have compressed gas inside them. And so understanding what's going to happen when that saturated oil is released into the environment, how does it explode? How does it create small droplets? Will dispersants be effective under those environmental conditions? How far will it drift? That is, what's the current speed at those great depths? Those are things we just don't know. And so, it's a new environment, and as much as we prepare for a spill like Deepwater Horizon, one of the problems is in oil response and other things in life is we keep preparing for the last war as opposed to fighting the war that actually will occur the next time around, and then the next major spill may in fact be a 2 mile deep oil spill.
Do you have any handle on how the oil industry would deal with something like that, and specifically maybe the question about dispersants again? Have we gained enough information about the use of dispersants to know whether that would be or wouldn't be part of the equation based on how dangerous the combination of oil and dispersants are?
That's a good question. One of the things is we know that the industry has invested quite a bit of money in trying to develop new technologies, so-called capping stacks, to instead of having an oil spill run for 87 days, that they would have some technology available that would actually fit over the top of a broken well and hopefully collect the oil before it reached the environment. And, the oil industry has invested something like $2 billion in capping stacks, which is useful. I mean, that gets to the response part of it. The question on dispersants is wide open at this point, and so one of the issues, though, is that if you look at where the oil industry is going, it's going farther and farther offshore, right? So the chances of oil coming into the marshes and wetlands becomes lower and lower at the farther offshore you go. And so if one of the reasons for dispersing the oil is so that it doesn't reach the shoreline, so then it becomes, do we really need to do that? As opposed to the uncertainties of the toxicity of the oil. And so a lot of these questions are simply unanswered. And this is where a number of people have suggested that we set up a set of laboratory facilities that more mimic what's going on and maybe even do some control releases to see if we can understand this thing at field level conditions.
Well, I think we have time for one quick question, if you don't mind. Let's go to Joe in Gulfport. Joe, can you ask your question fairly quickly, please?
Okay, yes. I'm just wondering if anybody else noticed this on the news, that all these other cursories that showed up unasked with real serious oil booms were turned away, and they showed our ships with our wimpy little pool noodle booms. How come we didn't let these other cursories actually care help with it?
All right, thanks for that question. Dr. Murawski, is that something that you know about, the other countries being turned away when they offered help? Maybe Cuba, was that one of them?
That's outside of my experience. Sorry.
And I vaguely remember something like that, but I don't know enough to talk about it right now, Joe, but I'll try to look into that and maybe post that information. But thank you for that question, and I want to thank you so much for joining us on WMNF 88.5 FM, Steve.
You're welcome, and thanks anytime.
All right, thank you so much. Steve Murawski is a professor at the University of South Florida College of Marine Science in St. Petersburg. He's the lead author of a 7-year study published in the journal Marine Science, Marine and Coastal Fisheries that looks at the makeup of marine organisms in the Gulf of Mexico from the U.S., Cuba, and Mexico. I want to thank everyone who called in today and texted and emailed. And if you'd like to leave a voicemail about this show with your thoughts, you can call me at 813-238-8001 extension 114. I'll play your message tomorrow morning at 11. You can also join the conversation online at WMNF.org/news. And I want to tell you about our show that's coming up on Friday at 11 in the morning on 88.5 FM. It's a special International Women's Day show. Mary and Arlene from a Woman's Point of View are going to host it. All the WMNF music shows beginning at 4 Friday morning. We'll play women's music. Friday is International Women's Day. And coming up after the NPR headlines right now, Midpoint Wednesday is coming up after the NPR headlines. Nola will be the host. And at 11 tomorrow morning, we'll get an update on the death penalty in Florida and about bills introduced in the new legislative session to end capital punishment in the state. Thank you to our engineers, Bill Grace and Jeff Haynes. Thanks to DT as well. Stay tuned for now for Midpoint Wednesday with Nola that's coming up after NPR headlines on WMNF. Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, Lakeland, and Clearwater. Thank you so much for listening.